Episode 1230, My Strength is My Story with Anna Levy Lyons. No Other Gods.
Moms, needing a little inspiration and a ray of hope? You've come to the right place. This is the show that you can turn to for just the pick-me-up you need. This is Create Your Now, Your Best Selfie. Here's your host, certified life coach, personal trainer, and nutritionist, Christiane Wargo. Staring at a stop
sign, watching people drive. Happy, happy day. I pray that your week is going wonderful. Today is a fabulous day. It's my favorite day of the week. It is My Strength is My Story series, and we have with us a fabulous woman. Her name is Anna Levy Lyons, and she just recently wrote a book on the politics of the Ten Commandments. Now, don't let that scare you. It's a very insightful interview. I encourage you to listen in. For those of you who are brand new to Create Your Now, friends and family of Anna's, welcome to our family. I'm so delighted of your presence. If you already haven't had the opportunity, you'll want to head on over to createyournow.com where you can learn more and to sign up for the Kisses newsletter, the Keep It Simple Strategy Everyday Solutions to Live, Love, and Impact. Now, before we get too deep into our conversation, a word from our sponsor, Health, Hope, and Inspiration with Reverend Percy McRae, created by Cancer Treatment Centers of America. This podcast was created to provide cancer care information and resources to the faith-based community. Here, Reverend McRae and his co-host Wayne Shepherd share practical ways to find health, hope, and inspiration along life's journey. You will be equipped and encouraged to care for and support cancer patients and their families. The podcast also features interviews with leading oncology professionals, dietitians, nutritionists, pastors, and everyday people who share their life experiences with cancer. I would encourage you to subscribe to this podcast at Health, Hope, and Inspiration. Maybe the Ten Commandments scare you just a little bit. Maybe you think that they really don't apply to your life now. Regardless of where you are on the spectrum, Anna sheds light on the politics of the Ten Commandments. And it's a very insightful interview. And during this interview, I would encourage you to listen with an open mind and an open heart as you begin making connections for yourself personally. Without further ado, let's welcome in Anna Levy Lyons, No Other Gods. Hello and welcome to Create Your Now. I am so excited. We have a reverend in the house. Her name is Reverend Anna Levy Lyons. No Other Gods is a brand new book she wrote. She is a wife of 11 years and a mother to their twins. Anna is a senior minister of First Unitarian Congregational Society in Brooklyn, New York. She earned her bachelor's degree of music from Brown University and a master's of divinity from the University of Chicago Divinity School. Anna's career has followed a winding path from founding a web startup to a singer-songwriter. That's a question we've got to ask her about. Maybe she'll sing for us too. She now is a brand new author of her book, No Other Gods, The Politics of the Ten Commandments. Welcome, my friend and sister in Christ. How are you, Reverend Anna?
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be here. I am doing well. We've got hot summer days right now in the spring in New York City. But I'm thrilled to be talking with you and in this community and space of faith and values.
Well, it's a delight to have you here. And thank goodness you're having some sunshine because winter seemed to really drag on this year.
Yes, it did.
Yeah. So it's a good thing that that's kind of put on the back burner. Well, Reverend Anna, what fills your heart with joy?
Oh, what fills my heart with joy? Music was the first thing that came into my head, and nature. I love being in the woods, trees, the smell of the fall. I love the ocean. Being in nature is where I feel most connected to God. I think a lot of people feel that way. It makes me really joyful. And I live in New York City, so I don't really get enough of it, but when I have a chance to be in a natural space, I feel that connection, and my soul is breathing again.
Oh, that is a wonderful feeling for sure. And with you being in the city, I have to ask, are you one that actually owns a vehicle or do you Uber it everywhere?
All right, so I'm embarrassed to say I own a vehicle, and this is only in New York would you hear this. It's actually parked at a parking lot that is so far away from our apartment that we have to take a subway to get to it.
Oh my goodness.
This is not something that people who live in the country or the suburbs can possibly relate to, but this is the life of New York, because all of the parking lots that are actually close to our apartment are so ridiculously expensive. It's like a second mortgage to have a you know, a parking spot. Wow. Nearby. So we park it way up in Harlem, and then when we want to get our car, we take the subway to go get it. So ridiculous, I know.
Well, you know, it's just the life of the city, but I had to ask it because I haven't ever lived in New York, but I lived in bigger cities like Houston, and it's a different lifestyle versus living in a smaller town or even rural areas.
Yeah, it is.
Well, what led you into the ministry?
From the time I was a little kid, literally, I felt like being a spiritual leader would be the best career, if you want to call it that, possible. It just seemed like that would be the right thing for me. But I wasn't raised with any religion. My heritage was Jewish, and my family had rejected Judaism and was raising me without any faith. But I still had this yearning for spirituality. I would go and visit churches and synagogues in my neighborhood, and I just felt like I was pressing my face against the glass, sort of longing for something that these people were experiencing. And I always thought, wow, I wish I could be a spiritual leader. I wish I could live, you know, full time in that world. Too bad I can't do that because I don't have a religion. So I did a whole bunch of other things for a while. As you noted, I was a singer-songwriter for a while. I did the whole dot-com boom, working for these web startups in San Francisco and Seattle in the 90s. But I kept coming back. I kept feeling called to the world of religion and spirituality. So I decided to become a professor of religion. I thought, at least if I can't be a clergy person, at least I could study religion academically and become a professor and teach and be at least intellectually engaged in that world. So I went to the University of Chicago Divinity School, and that was my plan, and I hated the purely academic study of religion because the spirit wasn't there. It was missing the entire point for me of what religion was all about. And so I kept returning to this question of how could I be on the faith side of the religious world, not just the intellectual side. And that led me to a career as a Unitarian Universalist minister, because Unitarian Universalism doesn't require you to have already been a member of a particular faith. In fact, most Unitarian Universalists actually were not raised. UU is the acronym that we use. We're not raised UU. When people come to it later in life, and it's very, very open. It doesn't have its own creed, actually. And so it's about supporting people in their individual spiritual journeys. And so that was a fit for me to be able to kind of bring my Jewish heritage and my own sort of naturalist spirituality into it and kind of bring myself and bring God as I experience God into my ministry.
Mm. Well, you wrote in your book, in your acknowledgments, you thanked your father for allowing him to really ask some of those deep thought-provoking questions.
Yeah. Yes. So he is a philosophy professor. And so from the time I was a little kid, he would ask me questions like, how do you know you really exist? Right? When I was like 7 years old. And so I'd have to think about that. How can I prove to my dad that I exist? Right?
Get in trouble.
Get in trouble. Yes. Hello, I'm here.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So he encouraged me to take nothing for granted, literally to take nothing for granted. And I think that that has been a tremendous gift that I've been able to carry with me into my ministry and into my writing of my book, because I don't just assume that the way that everybody thinks about things is the only way to think about them. Mm-hmm. So I'm very, really grateful to him for opening up my mind in that way.
Oh, and your mom was also a big influencer too in your life.
she is a musician. She's retired now. She was determined to be the first woman conductor of the New York Philharmonic, which never panned out. But she was definitely, she inspired a love of music for sure, and a sense that I can, as a woman, that I can do anything that I want to do. Because back, you know, when she was trying to make it as a conductor, she faced, not that women today don't face these kinds of issues, but she faced huge amount of discrimination because she was a woman, and it really got in the way of her career. But she didn't give up, and she sort of instilled in me a sense that we can do anything.
That's awesome. Family is so important, and you have a growing family too. I mean, you have twins.
Yes, I
can't imagine how busy your life is.
Yeah. It's crazy. It's a lot better now that they're 7 years old. And so now I think it's pretty much like having any two kids. The fact that they're twins doesn't make it any harder or easier. But yes, the first couple of years in particular were really, really difficult. But we survived, and just the fact that I was able to write a book in the last year and a half, I think shows me how much so much more manageable now. And I adore them, and they're just amazing, fascinating people, and they get more interesting all the time.
They do, and they'll get even more interesting, and they'll be like, oh, they're just such blessings. But they can be children, and you know, themselves can be just a handful, but they're definitely blessings.
Oh yes. Oh, yeah. And the fact that they're twins, there is a kind of intensity to their relationship with each other that, I didn't have anything like that in my life. And so watching it is incredible. And, you know, both the fighting and the antagonism, and also the love and the intimacy between them. And then that how they toggle between those two modes just like in seconds. It's intense. It's really intense.
Well, you'll have to make sure you get those nature walks in when you can.
Absolutely. Yes. And I'm trying to give that to them as well.
Well, in your book, No Other Gods, the subtitle is The Politics of the Ten Commandments. How do people react when you mention the Ten Commandments?
It depends on who they are and whether they already know me. People In the circles that I run in, which tend to be pretty progressive circles, people initially have either a negative to neutral sort of impression of the Ten Commandments. There's a sense that they represent sort of an old, dodgy, socially conservative way of being in the world, and so they don't really look any further than that. Or they just think that they're not that important because they're all just ethical principles that we all disagree on already. So we don't really need them because everybody knows, yeah, don't kill, don't steal, whatever, right? So I feel like my first job when I start to talk to people about the Ten Commandments and about my book is to convince them that both of those understandings are not right, and that actually the Ten Commandments give us an expansive, kind of spiritually grounded way to live our values in the world and to live deeper, more meaningful lives. And I found that people are pretty open to that.
So why did you commit yourself? Because you had, I mean, they were young ones. I mean, you had twins. Why did you commit yourself to writing this book on the Ten Commandments, No Other God?
I really feel like it came from God. I feel like there was a flow that happened where first I decided to preach a sermon series on the Ten Commandments. And for the reasons I just mentioned, I didn't know how that was going to go over with my congregation because they tend to be pretty skeptical about traditional religion, especially biblical traditions. But I wanted to open their eyes to some of what I thought was this just extraordinary beauty of these traditions. And the Ten Commandments seemed like a good starting point because they're so, you know, everybody knows about them. They're in the popular culture, right? They're just very well known, and people have strong feelings about them. So I decided to take a chance and preach a sermon series on the Ten Commandments. I did one each month over the course of a year. This was like 4 years ago. And to my surprise, people absolutely loved them. People loved these sermons more than anything else I had ever done. And they kept the sanctuary was always packed on Sundays when I was going to be preaching about the Ten Commandments. And people kept saying, you've got to turn these into a book. You've got to turn these into a book. People kept saying that. And then I had a friend who was an author who said, no, seriously, Anna, I really think that you could turn these into a book. And so I started to think, okay, I've always wanted to write a book. Maybe I can. Maybe this would be a good way to do that. And so I was just the very beginning of starting to make that decision that I was going to figure out, how do you get an agent? How does this whole process work? Literally, no more than 2 weeks later, I got an email from somebody who I didn't know saying, I'm a literary agent and I've been coming to your services and when you've been preaching about the Ten Commandments, and I'm wondering if you would consider turning these into a book.
Wow.
Yeah. So I met with her, we hit it off, and then she worked with me. It took a very long time to write the proposal, partly because of those pesky twins, and partly because it was the first time I had ever written a book proposal, and it's a very involved process. But she helped me and guided me through the process for a couple of years. And then finally we had something that we both liked, and she shopped it around, and I got a publisher very quickly. It just really felt like this flow just really happened.
Well, God obviously knew that you had a message, and he wanted you to get that message out to just coordinate every little detail.
I feel like that. I feel like the word that I use is micromanaging. I feel like God is micromanaging my life and this process in a good way, but in a very surprising and new way for me. Mm.
He definitely shows up in the smallest of details.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, that's exciting. Well, you all are going to want to pick up your own copy of her brand new book, No Other Gods, The Politics of the Ten Commandments. Well, in your opinion, Anna, how relevant are the Ten Commandments in today's society? Because like you said, people are kind of like, oh, it's old stuff. You know, it really doesn't apply. But in your opinion, how does it?
Oh, I think they are so relevant, maybe now more than ever. I feel like we increasingly live in a world that is hyper-individualistic and materialistic. And there's a sense that we're divided up into winners and losers, and people are ranked based on gender and race and all kinds of qualities. And I feel that the Ten Commandments have a vital message to call us back to a sense of accountability to one another, to placing God and the spirit of liberation and love in our lives, to place that at the center of our lives. I feel like that's basically what the Ten Commandments is calling us to do. And so it's not just about ethics. There have been a lot of books that have been written about the Ten Commandments as ethical prescriptions, which they are in part. But I also feel like they go two different directions away from ethics. Deep personal spiritual level, where they call us in our most private inner places to put God first in our lives and to orient our lives around the power of love and liberation. So goes that direction inward. And then it also goes outward to build, calling us to build a world in which we can all do that collectively. So the Ten Commandments were actually spoken in the scripture, in the Torah scripture. They were spoken in second person singular. So they were spoken to you, right, as an individual you, but they were also spoken to the community as a whole, because that whole gathered community at Mount Sinai that was listening to the voice of God speaking the Ten Commandments, that community in the biblical scripture is often referred to as a single entity. It's one thing, it. It refers to the community as it. And so these commandments were spoken to individuals, but they were also spoken to the community as a whole. And that's really significant because that's a whole different understanding of what they're calling us to do. Because, yes, they're calling us to not kill individually, but they're also calling us to create a society that doesn't kill. They're calling us to not steal individually, yes, but they're also calling us to create a society where theft isn't built into the economy in the way that we don't pay workers a living wage and we buy things made in sweatshops in third world countries where people aren't being paid enough to be able to live or even have safe working environments. So we can pay what a product costs on its price tag, but that's not actually paying the full amount that the person who made it would need to be able to make a living. So that's a kind of theft that our society as a whole does, right? So as a society, we're called to do these things. Keeping a Sabbath is another example of that. Yes, we're called to keep a Sabbath individually, but we're also called to create a society where everybody can create a Sabbath, where we're not forced to work all the time just to make ends meet. That's a compassionate society where we take care of each other so that everybody can take a Sabbath day. And that's very much the intention of that commandment in particular, because it says, don't do any work, not you or your son or your daughter or your male servant or your female servant or your animals or the alien who's living within your gates. It's not supposed to be just a Sabbath for the rich people. It's for everybody. So that's where I think on both the spiritual level and the broader social level, I think the commandments are really radical in what they're calling us to do.
In your first commandment that you write, which I don't think is technically the first chapter, but it's the first commandment within your book, you write, even the consonants Y, H, and V are open sounds associated with air and breath, not definition or finality.
Yes, this is a fascinating thing about the way that God introduces God's self at the beginning, when God is first speaking from the top of Mount Sinai, introducing God's self to the people, speaking directly to the people for the very first time. God says, I am. And then in English, the letters are YHVH. In Hebrew, it's Yud He Vav He, your God. And these four letters are the Hebrew verb to be, the verb to be. So it's being itself. So God, the idea of God being an old man with a long beard and, you know, sitting up in the sky somewhere, that's not the kind of God that's being introduced here. It's a God that is being, that is reality, that is the entire cosmos and everybody and everything. And so how do you experience a God like that? Well, those letter sounds, you're never supposed to try to pronounce that name for God in Jewish tradition, because when you try to pronounce something and you name it, it limits it and it makes it finite. And the whole idea of God as being is that it's infinite. And those letters themselves, if you were going to try to pronounce them, each one of them, if you think about a Y sound is Y, right, and an H sound is breath, and right, it's all these open sounds. So it's that sound of the infinite, it's the sound of that openness, possibility, breath, the life force that's contained in that name that means being. That's what we're supposed to be orienting our lives around.
Now, it's very powerful, because when you read it, I think in our little pea brain that we have, we only use a very small portion of it here as earthly beings. It's hard for us to really truly imagine and grasp the God that we serve, the God, the creator of the entire universe. And we want to place a picture, like you said, a guy that has a beard, whatever you want to make him look like in your head.
Right.
But there's nothing that we can do to place a picture on that when he is the creator.
Right, exactly. And that's one of the concepts that I feel like we're being challenged by the commandments to absorb and to try to take into our being, that sense of the unknowability of God and the really the infinite nature of God. That's something so fabulous about that. But you're right, it's really hard for us humans because we want so much to have something concrete. This is why the golden calf episode happened, right? People couldn't, when Moses was gone up the mountain, they couldn't hold in their minds and their hearts that idea of that God, that amorphous God of liberation that they had experienced before. And so they built this golden calf because they wanted something. They wanted something concrete that they could pray to, that they could focus their energies on. And we're being challenged to not do that, to try to leave it open, to try to leave it at wonder and awe.
Well, as we have mentioned here with the God, we're not to put, the first commandment is to put no other gods before God himself, the creator of the universe. How do you see the first commandment relating to us personally in today's world?
It's such a personal one because really there's no action that this commandment is requiring us to do or not do, right? It really is. The first one and the last one about not coveting is really private and personal. I think each one of us knows in our hearts when we are orienting our life around God and when we are worshiping other gods. And we all have other gods. All of us have other gods that we worship. And for each of us, it's different. I mean, for some of us, it's probably the same. We strive after power. We strive for money. We strive to be liked. We strive for the approval of others. And then it's different. It's different for different people have different needs that they try to get filled by these other gods in our society. And some of them are very private and hidden. Some of them we don't even know ourselves that we're doing it until we really pray on it and think about it and try to think of our lives through this lens of orienting more and more around God. Because these other gods are very tricky. they're not always that easy to see. Partly because our whole society supports them. Mm-hmm. Our whole society is telling us that if we can look better or lose 10 pounds, that we'll be happier. Right? Our whole society supports that. Everyone, you know, all the magazines and all our peers and Facebook and everything says, yep. Yep, you're right. Like, that's a God. If you pray to that God and you supplicate to that God in the right ways, that God will give you the blessings, right, that you're looking for. And so it's really hard to resist. It takes a very intentional resistance to all the messages that we're getting from society to try to keep this commandment. And we are never going to be even close to perfect, right? It's a journey of getting closer and closer.
And that golden calf that you talked about and shared, it doesn't show up as a golden calf in our life, but it's equal to that. And I think we kind of discount that, oh, well, I have this addiction to ice cream. For me, I talk about root beer floats in my journey. And it was just one thing. I love sweets, period. But that can be an addiction. That can be my golden calf, my root beer floats. Yes. And, you know, that can bring destruction to my life and my relationship to God, and that can become my other God. And I think it really takes that internal looking inward, that reflection of going, okay, Lord, show me those other gods that I'm putting before you.
Yeah.
You know, because we all have them. Like you said, we all have them.
Yeah. And I think it's to discover what they are. I think we need to look at what are we looking to for a kind of salvation. Right. What are we looking to that's going to give us, that's going to fill the hunger inside us, right? Root beer floats can fill a kind of hunger, right? What are we looking for to fill our emptiness? What are we looking for to make us feel good about ourselves, to make us feel strong and vital, to make us feel beautiful, right? What are we looking for to give us those gifts and those blessings? And most of them are ultimately, at their core, they're spiritual blessings that those other gods are not ever going to give us.
So very true. Well, as you wrote this book, Anna, which commandment did you struggle with personally?
That's a good question. I mean, some combination of the first and the last, right? The just what we were just talking about. The looking for the approval of others, I think, is a tough one for me as a minister, as a woman. Women are taught that we should try to be liked all the time, right? So I'm always struggling with saying things to my congregation that maybe they don't want to hear. And so when I choose not to do that, when I shy away from kind of speaking the truth as I'm experiencing, you know, God calling me to speak it, when I shy away from that, I think that that's me worshiping other gods, wanting so much for that, the approval of my congregation or the approval of the public or whoever it is, that I'm not saying what I need to say and being who I need to be. So that's where I really struggle with it personally and in my ministry.
Yeah, those can be stumbling blocks for all of us, especially that people pleaser aspect of it. Man, that people pleaser piece of pie, everybody wants to take a bite of it, but then they want to also escape it at the same time. But oh, it is so tempting. And for women, especially as moms, in our life, just our personal lives, we're trying to people please our husbands, people please our children, people please their teachers, people please. Yeah. I mean, the list is like forever long. It's like Santa Claus or something.
That's right. Yeah. And if somebody's not happy with you, it's a kind of failure, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Indeed. Well, when people pick up their copy of their own book, because I know they're going to want to, what do you hope your readers will gain when they read No Other Gods?
I hope that they will gain a sense of the connection between their own personal spiritual practices, their own spirituality, and the wider society. There's something... I think you can, in some ways, boil this book down to the idea that the personal is political, right? That the things that we do personally have these ramifications out into the wider world, and that we have responsibilities to one another, not just in our interpersonal interactions, but people who live on the other side of the planet, because we're all completely interconnected. So I would love for people to take away the idea that your inner spiritual journey has powerful ramifications in the world. We will, depending on how your own sort of relationship with God and your own ability to orient your life around God, you're going to live differently. And that way of living differently is going to have an impact in the world. And you're either going to be part of the flow of that love and liberation, or you're going to be resisting the flow of love and liberation. But there's a lot at stake in what we do. It matters what we do. I guess that's a simple way to put it. It matters what we do, and it matters why we do it.
We need to really think about that, because I think a lot of us are just living by either rote habits, like we were raised this way, or we just kind of do whatever because we just fall into it, and we make up excuses. Oh, I really didn't mean to, or whatever. You know, I mean, it could be as simple as I'm going to Starbucks to buy a cup of coffee, and you cut somebody off on the way or whatever, and you're yelling and screaming at him. How is that showing kindness and compassion and being the person that you are supposedly supposed to be living out? It's like, whoa, we're living almost two sides of the coin here.
Absolutely. And I think people are busy. People are overwhelmed, right? We don't have the kinds of community structures that we used to have that can help people. And so, to some extent, it feels like when you think about commandments, when you think about also having to, you know, worry about, well, what am I buying and how's that going to affect somebody in Bangladesh? Like, I can't even manage my own life, much less, right? Which is why I think it's crucial to see it as a journey and as that we're always going towards a center of connection with God, and not that it's a pass or fail test, right? That we're always going there. And then in the very end of my book, I acknowledge that I think that the commandments can also be read as blessings for people, where it's like, I can't take on one more thing in my life. Then they express a hope for kind of a future you or a future world where may you have no other gods but God, right? May you at some point reach that place in your life where you're not a slave to these other gods in your world, right? May you not have to steal in your life. May you be able to take a Sabbath. May you be able to create a life for yourself where you can have time to just experience awe at the universe and gratitude and time with people that you love. May that be a reality for you someday. And I think that's an easier way for people to even think about moving towards it, because it's less finger shaking, right? And more like this is a vision for our lives, and let's see if we can sort of gently like ease ourselves into a life of greater alignment.
And some people are really just afraid, Anna, that the commandments, these rules that we have to follow, restrict us, and mm-hmm. that we can't live the life that we really think that we mm-hmm. want to be living.
Yeah. Well, I'm so glad you brought that up, because I think that that's one of the misunderstandings of the modern world, where we believe that when we let go of religious laws, that therefore we're free, right? When we let go of religious laws, we don't follow any laws at all, and so we're free. But in reality, it doesn't work that way, because the religious laws, like take Sabbath, for example, right? Modern liberal people tend to think, I don't have time for that, and I don't need it. I'll take time off when I want to, and whatever. But the fact is that without having an actual Sabbath practice, people never take a break. They never take a break from working, consuming, shopping, striving to improve themselves, right? We never stop. And so we may think that we're free because we're not keeping these arbitrary Sabbath rules about when you can and can't work. But actually, if you do keep these arbitrary laws, you actually find a huge freedom in that from the laws of our secular society. Laws of our secular society tell us you have to always be producing or consuming or improving and striving, right? And you find that if you allow yourself, if you submit to actual religious laws about having there be a time that is sacred, then you find within that space this unimaginable freedom, that actually this is that one day is when you're actually living your life, right? And so that's an amazing, it's a real paradox, I think, of our time that I would love for people to understand better.
Well, in your book, you share a story, Anna, about a woman named Joy.
Yes.
And yeah. So share a little bit about that.
Yeah. So this is a congregant here at the church, and she had been a Mormon, and so she had grown up with a Sabbath practice, a very strict Sabbath practice on Sundays, and she had very positive memories of that. But as an adult, she and her husband, who also grew up Mormon, they drifted away from Mormonism, and there were a lot of aspects of it that didn't work for them anymore. And they sort of thought they would continue keeping a Sabbath, but because they were no longer identifying as Mormons, all the religious laws in their lives were becoming less important. And so every Sabbath they used to put on special music and have a special meal, and they wouldn't work and they wouldn't shop, right? That was the Mormon tradition. And then one Sunday evening, Joy was trying to prepare a meal, and she realized that they were missing cinnamon, and it was very important that cinnamon be part of this meal. So she was like, well, I'll just go just this once to the store and just pick up some cinnamon, and it'll be fine. So she goes and she picks up the cinnamon, and nothing bad happens, and she makes her meal. And the next week, it's something else. Oh, yeah, it would be really great to have some bread or some cheese to go with dinner tonight. Let's just go to the store and we'll just pick up those two things. We'll still stay in the spirit of the Sabbath the whole time. So they go and pick up those two things and maybe one other thing at the store. And so the story goes on that basically every Sunday now they start shopping. And then one Sunday her husband is like, I really, you know, needed to finish up this project. I'm just going to do for, you know, half an hour. And she's like, all right, well, then I'll work for a half an hour too. And pretty soon the Sabbath is gone. Sunday is just another day. And they realized that that was, at that point in their life, they would reach their Sunday nights with anxiety. They'd be stressed out, even though they had gotten more done, right? They had a whole other day of the week now to get their stuff done. But they were stressed out. They felt like they couldn't face the week ahead. They were fighting with each other. And they realized what they had lost. Because they had, it's the slippery slope, right? They had thought that they don't need to be strict about these laws, right? That one little thing, going out and getting a jar of cinnamon, is not going to hurt anybody, right? But it turned out that that led to another thing, which led to another, and they lost their entire practice, which was really dear to them, and they had lost it. So that's an example of how these religious laws, being very kind of strict about them, seems restrictive, and it is, right? You are giving up certain freedoms, but you're also gaining something immeasurable that you really can't get any other way.
And that's the key there, what you just said. You're gaining something that you can't get any other way. Yeah. And we're trying to fill that void, though, Anna, with other stuff like shopping, like, you know, going to our big box stores. And here in the U.S., it's totally different than in some other countries. Other countries kind of have it right. I mean, some of them shut down for nap time, you know, during the weekday. And they make things a priority, and they make those shifts, where here in the U.S., we're like, oh, no, grind harder and more and get out there. And, man, take your email home at work and boss can still get in touch with you. And, oh, wait, but we're going to still reach you. If we can't reach you by email, we're going to find you on Instagram and Facebook, too. And we're going to talk to you that way. You know, what is it? You know, when will enough be enough?
Right. Yeah. Well, that's the disease of our time, is enough is never enough. And that's having a devastating impact on our environment, which in turn is having a devastating impact on human beings around the world right now. That we have internalized this idea that we have a right to just take and take and take from each other and from the natural world. And we're doing that to the point that it's collapsing, that the ecosystems that God made to sustain us are actually collapsing because we never feel like we have enough. And that we always think that the next thing, getting the next thing, is going to actually make us happy and fulfilled, and it never does, and then we go to get the next thing. But if we allowed ourselves to have limits, the limits that God gave us, the limits that are natural human limits to what we take from the earth and what we take from one another, then we would live with abundance. And our natural environment would be able to sustain us all, and we would be able to live more compassionately and take care of each other better. But we have to accept those limits on our freedom in order for that to happen. We need to feel that we have enough.
Yeah, so in actuality, the Ten Commandments can actually bring vitality back into our life.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm.
Yeah. Well, as you were writing this book, Reverend Anna, did you seem to, you know, was there like a theme that was running through as you were writing, you were picking up different things going, wow, I can so see how all this is connected?
Mm. I think exactly what we were just talking about, the sort of the ecological thread and in the larger sense of enoughness, right? That all of the breaking of the commandments involves us trying to grab more from the universe, like more for ourselves, trying to change, like even if you kill somebody, right? You're trying to kind of interrupt the natural sort of flow and abundance of the universe because it's not good enough the way that it is, right? I mean that's an extreme example, but we don't have that sense of enoughness. We don't cultivate that sense of enoughness in our culture. And so we don't feel like we have enough. And so we just take and we take and we take and we take. And every one of the commandments is about a version of that taking, right? Adultery. like I don't have enough with the person that I'm with, and so I want to take more. Lying is always a way of sort of trying to manipulate reality so that you can have more than you would naturally have if you were telling the truth about whatever it is. Because the truth about who you are, the truth about what you've done is not going to give you enough. Right? So you need to take more. So I think all of the commandments are a little bit about kind of staying in our lane and having gratitude for the gifts and the abundance that we already have. And we're just seeing, again, with the ecological breakdown that we're seeing right now, the climate and water shortages and famine around the world, we're seeing the end result of societies that are based on that kind of taking from the earth and from vulnerable people. So I think that's the thread in the Ten Commandments.
Well, if you guys want to do a deeper dive, you're going to want to pick up your own copy of No Other Gods, The Politics of the Ten Commandments. People who are saying, okay, I know I've fallen off, I'm not perfect, I get that. But if I really want to live out the Ten Commandments, how do you live out the Ten Commandments in a fallen world?
Ooh, yeah. Well, I think it's the think globally, act locally idea, right? We don't have control over everything that happens out there in the world. But I think, as I was saying before, I think that there is a message contained even in the idea that we are being commanded at all. There's a message contained that what we do matters, and that when we individually try to keep the commandments and orient our lives around them, that has an impact. And when I say individually, I don't just mean in the literal sense of not stealing somebody's cell phone, but in the sense of what does it mean to participate in systems that don't steal and to not participate in systems that do, right? To think about our own participation, not just in our, you know, interpersonal interactions, but in the larger social structures that we're part of, our consumer practices and the ways that we set up our organizations, even from PTAs, right? I mean, every organization that we're part of has a kind of a theology or a set of values, at least like implicitly, even if nobody talks about it, every organization that we're part of has these values that are implicitly running it. So what are those values? Let's go out and question the values of the organizations and institutions that we're a part of, and how can we as individuals help guide those values towards health, towards a sense of abundance and compassion, instead of the ethic of taking and taking. Mm-hmm. Right. So I think that keeping the commandments individually is about spiritually getting aligned, right? But also figuring out how we, through the circles that we already influence, how can we help to create a world and a broader society that actually aligns with that God energy.
Some deep thought. Oh, you guys got to get it out, because, you know, dig into it. You know, No Other Gods. We got to get back to some of our roots, the roots of the Ten Commandments, what God spoke himself to Moses. And it's pretty incredible. And I believe on your cover here, is this Mount Sinai?
Yes, it is.
Okay, yeah.
Well, it's what people believe was Mount Sinai. Of course, no one really knows, but yes.
Right, okay, yeah. So, but we'll have all the links in the show notes for you all to go and pick up your own copy of No Other Gods. I know, Anna, people are going to want to connect with you and find you. Where can they?
The easiest way is my website, www.annalevylyons, AnnaLevylyons.com. So you can read more about me, you can read my blog, and you can, you know, click links to buy the book.
Fabulous. Well, we will have all that information in the show notes. But before I let you go, Anna, I have one last question for you.
Yeah.
The series is called My Strength is My Story. What has your story gifted you?
Whew. faith. I have this story of my life, in particular the story of how this book came to be, has given me so much trust. I was telling you before the word micromanaging, that God is micromanaging my life. And I feel like I have, in the last couple of years, I've gained so much trust in that. And so when things happen now that I think are bad things, I think, you know what? Maybe that's actually not going to be such a bad thing. Let me just hold off on, you know, deciding whether this is a bad or a good thing. Because it seems like God has a plan here. And that's something that's pretty new for me. And it's exciting.
Well, I'm excited to see how God continues to work through you in your congregation and for those who are reading your book. Thank you so much for your time. It's been such a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you. It's been so great to talk with you.
Feeling inspired, ready to train for life, and love your journey? Visit createyournow.com for more incredible resources to help you along the way. We'll see you next time on Create Your Now, Your Best Selfie. And remember, always be sure you consult your physician before beginning any health and fitness plan.